For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. As many of you know, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum programs are recorded for New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's talk may be heard on NHPR next Sunday at 9 p.m. The talk will also be available on our own website, monadnocklyceum.org, as a podcast within a few days. Our speaker today is Dr. Keith McGee. Keith McGee is an internationally sought-after theologian, social justice, and poverty scholar. He is a distinguished senior fellow at the Edward Cadbury Center for the Public Understanding of Religion at the University of Birmingham in England. He is also the director of the Social Justice Institute that is hosted at the Boston University School of Theology. He holds a doctorate in theology from Harvard University. For 5 years, he served as the founding director of the National Public Housing Museum and Center for the Study of Housing and Society in Chicago, which is committed to offering a living cultural experience regarding social justice and human rights. This appointment was offered to him after his service as senior religious affairs advisor with the Obama for America campaign and as a senior director at the Museum of African American History in Boston and Nantucket. Rooted in the Methodist tradition, Dr. McGee's ministerial calling has led to pastoral leadership at several churches in Boston and in Washington, D.C. He has served on the White House African American Clergy Network and is former chair of the Massachusetts Council of Chaplains for Governor Deval Patrick. Additionally, he is passionate about providing humanitarian aid to children and families throughout the world. He is co-founder of Abba House, created for children affected by HIV and AIDS, and he has worked to develop a chaplaincy model for hospitals in Rwanda. Dr. McGee has been extremely active in boards and institutions committed to social justice, from the Sankofa Justice and Equity Fund that was founded by Harry Belafonte to the Anti-Defamation League's World of Difference Institute, among many others. And as dyslexic, one of his most significant accomplishments is the co-founding of the Multicultural Dyslexia Award Initiative at the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. Dr. McGee is also the author of a book entitled A Prayer for Our Children, which came out in 2014, and he's also authored a new book to be published this fall entitled Restoring Hope, 50 Years of Remembering, Retelling, and Reframing the Civil Rights Era. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Keith McGee.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And thank you, Nancy, and to the Lyceum Committee for extending this gracious invitation to me to join you here in this most beautiful brick and millstone town. As I prepare to return to England in 2 weeks to my small community outside of Birmingham, you've gotten me excited about going home to England, having been here overnight. I'm equally elated to be here in this space, in this Peterborough Unitarian Universalist Church, on a Sunday morning. As a good Methodist minister, this is an appropriate place to stand on a Sunday morning, and I promise you that I will not ask for a collection or give you a morning scripture. Michael Sandel is the Ann T. and Robert M. Bass Professor of Government at Harvard. He teaches a course on justice where he poses a question: what is the right thing to do? Over 20,000 students now have taken Professor Sandel's course. He evokes Aristotle's concept of morality to examine the missing element that is missing in democratic debate. He asked his students the same question that Aristotle asked over 2,300 years ago. He says to the students in Sandel's theater, suppose we're giving out flutes. He says, who should get the best flutes? Audience members have three options: the best flute player, the worst flute player, or the random citizen. Aristotle sides with the best flute player because he says that flutes are meant to be played well. That's their purpose. Sandel argues that when making such a decision, we have to consider the purpose of a thing as well as the qualities in it worth being honored. He says, and I quote, "There is a tendency to think that if we engage too directly with moral questions, that we create a recipe for disagreement and, for that matter, a recipe for intolerance and coercion." Sandel concludes that it seems to me a better way to have mutual respect is to engage directly with moral convictions that citizens bring to public life, rather than for people to leave their deepest moral convictions outside the door before entering. I invite you this morning to bring your deepest moral convictions with you into this space, because we need them for our thoughtful conversation about race in America in order to have a real discourse. My favorite movie of all times is Eve's Bayou. It takes place in the Tennessee Williams country of the Deep South. With all that is said about me, with all of my accolades and accomplishments, I'm really a country boy from the Bayou of Louisiana. The bayous of Louisiana are strange and wonderful places. I grew up playing with crocodiles, alligators. Imagine that. The bayous are strange and wonderful places, a world all to their own, filled and overflowing with a wealth of stories and thematic possibilities. In this movie, Eve's Bayou, the director introduces us to the rarest of motion picture moments with this opening stunning line. It opens in the bayou and she says, "Memories." It's a selection of images, some elusive, others written indelibly upon the brain. "Memories." It's a selection of images, some elusive, others written indelibly upon the brain. 100 years ago in 1915, President Woodrow Wilson, as President of the United States, hosted a special screening at the White House of A Birth of a Nation, a film directed by W.D. Griffith, based upon what was originally named The Klansman, a novel written by Wilson's good friend Thomas Dixon. The film represented a distorted portrayal of the South after the Civil War. It glorified the Ku Klux Klan and degenerated blacks. It falsified the period of Reconstruction by representing blacks as dominating Southern whites. Almost all of those are in this film are false in its presentation. It deals with this identity of black men sexually forcing themselves on white women. The Klan was portrayed as the South's savior from this alleged tyranny. Not only was this portrayal untrue, it was the opposite of what was actually happening. During Reconstruction, whites dominated blacks and actually assaulted black women. The Klan was primarily a white terrorist organization that carried out hundreds of murders. After seeing the film, an enthusiastic President Wilson reportedly remarked, quote, "It's like writing history with lightning, and my only regret is that it is all so terribly true," end quote. African-American audiences wept at the film's malicious portrayal of blacks, while northern whites cheered. The film swept the nation. Riots broke out in major cities in Boston and Philadelphia, amongst others, yet it was denied access in places like Chicago, Cleveland, Denver, Pittsburgh, Minneapolis. White gangs roamed streets attacking blacks. In Lafayette, Indiana, a white man killed a black teenager after seeing the movie. Thomas Dixon reveled in his triumph. He said, "The real purpose of my film was to revolutionize Northern audience that would transform every man into a Southern partisan for a lifetime." As the NAACP fought against the film and tried unsuccessfully to ban it, the Ku Klux Klan successfully used it as a massive recruitment campaign that would bring millions of members. Griffith later regretted this racial prejudice that his film promoted. He tried to make amends by making Intolerance, a film attacking racial prejudice, but Intolerance never approached the success of Birth of a Nation. As we deal with the issues of race in America, we have to deal with what many of people simply want to erase without accepting that memory is a selection of images, some elusive, some written indelibly upon the brain. The historic narrative of the Negro, the colored in America, is seen primarily through the lens of segregation. Pronounced as Jim Crow in the South and being masked but overt in the North, the Midwest, and the West as separate and unequal, that is a long-lived memory. America's history, even though slaves became free, is the ideal of marginalization and a people who saw themselves as less than equal. The migration from the South to other parts of the country became a way of escape, but racism, defined as prejudice, discrimination, antagonism directed against someone of a different race based upon a belief of another having superiority, remained a reality and a part of memory. W.E.B. Du Bois, or Du Bois if you wish, through his prophetic utterance wrote, as it were, at the beginning of the 20th century, three key and essential understandings about the dynamics of race and the future of America and that of the Negro. In his talented tenth that appeared in The Negro Problem, he described the likelihood that one-tenth of black men would become leaders through methods such as education, through writing books, or becoming directly involved with social change. He argued that 10% would be given access, and the remaining 90% would exist and offer some sort of stabilization if resources were made available to them. I'm arguably a part of Du Bois's 10%. Du Bois also considered in the souls of black folks that the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the color line. The relation of darker to lighter races in Asia and Africa, in America and in the islands of the sea. He addressed the concerns that over half of the world would be denied the right of sharing and obtaining opportunities and privileges of modern civilization, all because of the varying complexions of their skin. Can you imagine that? That the lighter you were, the more you had access. The darker you were, the less access you would have. And in 1909, Du Bois wrote this about America. In Black Reconstruction in America, Du Bois introduced something else. He introduced a concept called psychological wage. This psychological wage, Du Bois argued, was for white laborers. This special status, he argued, divided the labor movement by leading low-wage white workers to feel superior to low-wage white workers. Du Bois identified white supremacy as a global phenomenon affecting social conditions around the world by means of colonizing. For instance, Du Bois wrote, quote, "It must be remembered that the white group of laborers, while they receive a low wage, were compensated in part by a sort of public and psychological wage. They were given public deference, titles of courtesy, because they were white. They were given public deference. They were given admittance freely, all because they were white. They were allowed to exist in public functions. They were allowed to exist in public parks. They were allowed to attend the best schools. The police were drawn from their ranks. The courts, dependent upon their votes, treated them with leniency and allowed lawlessness. Their votes selected public officials, and while they had little effect upon economic situations, it had great effect upon their personal treatment, and deference was showed upon them." Du Bois goes on to say that white schools were in the best communities and conspicuously placed, and their costs were anywhere from twice to 10 times as much per capita as schools of color. The newspapers specialized on news that flattered poor whites and almost utterly ignored Negroes except for crime and ridicule, end quote. This concept of W.E.B. is where we get the backdrop to understand what is argued as white privilege. This is something that was argued by Theodore Allen, an American intellect and writer and activist. Allen is best known for his pioneering writing since the 1960s on the invention of white race. He decided to define white race. His seminal Class Struggle and the Origins of Racial Slavery, The Intentions of the White Race, was published in a pamphlet in 1975, where he goes on to talk about this identity that white privilege is understood to be that white skin equates to power. White skin means that I have status. White skin means that I am superior, while black and brown skin equates to I need to earn my place in the world. Black and brown skin means that I'm inferior. Black and brown skin means that I am lesser than. As America has grappled with these issues of race and memory, we find ourselves constantly in a war of what do we do with this horrible past and the reality of what stands before us. Over the last year, we all know about this hashtag Black Lives Matter movement. It has been primarily because of the loss of Michael Brown's life in Ferguson, Missouri, along with the countless other loss of black lives here in the States, from Trayvon Martin to Eric Gardner to Freddie Gray, now along with Sandra Bland and countless others. The issue becomes that those lives were lost seemingly due to whites in power? Is that it? And this outcry is, you don't understand me, Mr. White Man, that black lives matter? And what seems to happen is that America, this nation that has made so much progress, gets set back because of painful memory, this selection of images, some elusive, some written indelibly upon the brain, rather than her being able to be conscious of her progress. We're not able to speak to our progress because something happens that affects 50, and yet how many millions of Americans are there? We cannot reason with America and herself and her new offsprings because of what happens with a few. Does America have a problem, or has America not addressed her memory? What is happening across America isn't a time for us to be collectively silent, but I believe it is, in fact, an opportunity for us to have an open and honest conversation without us leaving our deepest convictions outside the door before entering. Not only should blacks be outraged by the loss of black lives to those who are in power, but it should be a hashtag whether the life is taken by a white with privilege or anyone in power, or whether it's a child in Pakistan or Burundi or a man in Warsaw or Caracas or a woman in Bolivia or Delhi. All lives should matter, and we as a collective should be comfortable to speak about it and to speak up about it. And there should be a certain indignation by all of us that have breath in our bodies at the loss of a life, regardless of the life, a black on black on the south side of Chicago, or someone suffering from mental illness of a suburb in Colorado. We should all have something to say about it. Is it hashtag Black Lives Matter, or is it hashtag All Lives Matter? Cornel West in 1993 argued that the main obstacle of harmonious race relations in the United States is all about this concept that he wrote about called nihilism, the sense of worthlessness that exists among blacks. In his profound book, Race Matters, West explains his philosophy and calls on blacks and whites to understand that race and racism are woven in America's history and can never be eradicated without understanding that race matters and everything we consider American is connected with race. In this chapter, Nihilism in America, West observes that the liberal and the conservative conversation conceals the most basic issues now facing Black America, and that nihilism threats its very existence. This threat is not simply a matter of relative economic deprivation or political powerlessness through economic well-being or political clout or requisite for meaningful Black progress. It is primarily a question of speaking to a profound sense of psychological depression, personal worthlessness, and social despair. He says that nihilism is to be understood not as a philosophical doctrine, but it is far more about a lived experience of coping with a life of horrifying meaninglessness, hopelessness, and most important, lovelessness. People don't feel loved. Nihilism is not new to just Black America. Nihilism is new to America. Have you ever walked down the street and passed somebody that just looked angry? And you yourself felt, I'm not loved right now. You did nothing about it but walked down the street. There are these real issues that we face in America that challenge us. But for people who feel marginalized, they go back to something called memory. It is what affects them most. Whereas I support West's argument about nihilism, this lack of love and a need for love to emerge and to show itself strong for Blacks to overcome these identity issues and these problems, but is it love that overcomes white supremacy? Is it love that fights oppression? Is it love that causes someone to gain hope? Is it love that causes someone to have victory over self? Or is there something more intrinsic in a person that causes themselves to see themselves differently? Earlier this month, we celebrated one of the most significant milestones in the progress of America: the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act that was signed on August 6, 1965. This was a second part of a hurdle, the first being the Civil Rights Act of 1964, for America to overcome its ills towards the least advantaged among us. This was arguably forced courage by President Lyndon Johnson. One of the things that I'm often challenged by with this selective memory around race and the fight for equality in America is that we all too often forget the prophetic cries of this ecumenical group of people who became the catalyst for the movement of a righteous America. There were faith leaders who use their sacred spaces to address the concerns of the least advantaged among them. There were journalists like Dorothy Day, a white Catholic female, who used her journalism as a place to make a difference and an impact. There was Rabbi Herschel, who used his place not only in the synagogue, but in the academy to have impact. There were others who were social workers who used their places to inform policy and protocol for change. As America's society, founded on a hunger and a thirst for religious freedom, was turning a deaf ear to the pleas of marginalized people, certain that God's creation suffered no stratification, there were like-minded people across racial identity leading the charge for equality. These interfaith leaders, these people across faith and religion and ethnicity, debated, protested, collaborated on their like social, cultural, and political views, leading the way to the historic signing of the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act. These acts made tangible the lofty ideals of an American experience, rendering equal under the law a present reality for all people, regardless of color, sex, and religious belief. This gave way for all Americans to be able to stand together and talk about race and equality, not as a singular people, not as a monolithic reality, but for all. There were as many whites as African Americans. There were as many Unitarians as there were Jews. There were as many Black Baptists as there were white Catholics. There were as many Black women frying chicken as there were white women making sandwiches. All standing together, shoulder to shoulder, saying something is wrong with America and we must do something about it. So we have, as a collective, sort of become cowards. In open spaces across racial demographics in America, we've become cowards. We can only talk in intellectual spaces. We are afraid to approach each other in the coffee shop because we've become cowards. We don't want to have open forums and be transparent. We don't want to be, if you will allow me to be a good preacher for 30 seconds, naked and ashamed and not ashamed in the garden, to share our true feelings so that we can learn from each other. Is it that we too might be afraid that we are racist? It is understood that a racist is a person that believes a particular race is superior to another. That's what we say that a racist is, but is there something in me that is afraid of you, and therefore because of my fear? It's not about superiority, it's about my fear, and my fear holds me back from being able to talk to you, and my fear manifests something that someone else identifies me as a racist, and it's not that I'm a racist, it's that it's my fear. For 5 years, I had the honor of leading the National Public Housing Museum in Chicago. The museum's mission is to convey a complex story, but no less an American story, that is infused with artistic impact. There has been this illumination of drugs and violence and stolen childhoods, and there's also been flower gardens and helpful neighbors and hope for the future, which is the true story of public housing, both at different times and sometimes both at the same time. The story of public housing is very complex, but it starts with the simple truth that all people need a place to call home. And in those places, things happen to develop elements of life and death, character and karma, hope and impossibility. The museum is a museum of real people with real issues where I argue that poverty becomes art. The National Public Housing Museum is committed to being more than objects and artifacts. Its mantra is that we are the sum of our stories. The collection of residents and architects, policymakers and gangbangers and city planners and human services providers, sisters frying up hair in the kitchen, and brothers lighting up interesting things that smell interesting as you walk by, people making rock and roll music and hip-hop, selling chicken dinners to graffiti that they now call murals, and people's lives telling their stories, creating masterpieces, a tapestry. So I really enjoyed the work, if you can't tell. I was once taking an oral history from a woman who had a massive leadership role in the projects. She allowed me to call it the projects. She said, "This is the projects. This is the bricks," she told me. I inquired with her about the projects, about this whole issue of social change, what was happening there in the projects during her 42 years. She went on to tell me how horrible the community had become since the Julios had moved in. African-American woman. She said, "The Julios have moved in and the music is loud. They park their cars on the lawn and they have too many children. And their food smells funny." I listened. I said to myself, this African-American woman is a racist. She is using her power and her superiority to condemn another race. I asked her what she thought of racism of whites towards black, and what she told me I won't share with you because it's being recorded and I like you all. When I asked her if she regarded herself as a racist towards our Hispanic brothers and sisters, and if she saw a parallel with what she felt towards whites, she said, "Absolutely not." There are great philosophers from all genres of life that I look to help me deal with these things. There was one that I referred to her by the name of Michael Jackson. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of him. I shared with her some words that he had penned once when he said, "I'm starting with the man in the mirror. I'm asking him to change his ways." No message could have been any clearer. If you want to make the world a better place, take a look at yourself, then make a change. 25 years ago, Spike Lee created a movie, Do the Right Thing. The movie takes place on the hottest day of summer and revolves around Sal's famous pizzeria, apparently the only white-owned business in the Brooklyn neighborhood. Sal and his two sons, Nino and Vito, are not without their own racial tendencies, but nevertheless, they manage to coexist with their black customers. Rather than being clear about rights and wrongs, Do the Right Thing instead is a cultural cognition that is cumulatively a portrayal of an ethnic diverse contemporary urban American neighborhood. Three quarters of the film establishes the tone and the tenor of the neighborhood by introducing us to a series of interesting characters. Mookie, who works for the delivery man Sal, and DeMayor and Mother Sister, the neighborhood elder statespeople, and Radio Raheem, who always has a boombox and is a source of constant irritation for Sal. And then there's this dude called Bugging Out, who is angry over Saul's wall of famed, featured, exclusive Italian-Americans. This anger urges his fellow African-American Brooklynites to boycott Sal's. The catalyst of it is the racial tension lived out in this oppressive Brooklyn dreadful heat and humid time in a dreadful dead heat of summer. The difference between the Italians and the blacks in the neighborhood are accentuated by the music of this complicated character's ethnicity. The Italians favor Sinatra's ballads. The African Americans are listening to rap, and most notably, Public Enemy. All things come to a head when Radio Raheem refuses to turn down his radio while in Saul's, and Saul and Radio Raheem get into a fight. The police are called, and an ugly situation turns to worse, and the police arrive, and the police kill Radio Raheem in an effort to subdue them. The crowd outside of Saul's, gathered by Bugging Out, protests And Saul's ethnic singular wall of fame becomes the source of irritation, and a mob breaks out, and Mookie starts a full-scale riot and throws a trash can into Saul's window. And bedlam ensues, and Saul's is first looted and then burned to the ground. A film 25 years ago. The film's deceptive title becomes not so much a question, but it evokes a level of consciousness on what is the right thing to do. And what factors should people consider when determining what is right for them to do? I believe that we all have something to do. What is right for me to do may not be what is right for you to do, but you have something to do. A few minutes ago, as I began, and I'm preparing to wrap up with you because I think I'm doing well with time, I talked about President Woodrow Wilson, who was the sitting president 100 years ago. Let me prepare to close by talking about our sitting president today. President Obama, who I've had the pleasure of serving for during both of his presidential elections and on his African American Clergy Council. While I love our beloved president and have a personal relationship with him, I do have a critical critique. I certainly appreciate his two direct speeches that he's done on race and the passionate way that he spoke about Trayvon Martin in particular when he said, if I had a son, that he would look like Trayvon. One of the opportunities that I think President Obama has missed, yet still has time to address, is the opportunity to speak more in depth about race in America from a mixed race perspective. The excitement about him being the first African-American president is cool. I like it. All of that, but there's so much more of a larger context that America has missed. And there's an opportunity to really talk about race in America if we can just talk about this guy whose mother was from Wichita, Kansas, from a predominantly English ancestry of German, Swiss, Scottish, Irish, and Welsh ancestry. If we could talk about his grandmother, who was a good Methodist, who raised him, who was also from Kansas, who moved to Hawaii, and then talk about the fact that his father was Kenyan, not African American, but his father was Kenyan and that he had little relationship with him, and the fact that he was raised, in fact, by two American white women. What does that mean? What does that say about us arguing about an African-American president? Is this not yet an opportunity to talk about race in America? Is this not a true call for a conversation? As he remarked in 2008 in an interview, in a speech that he gave, he said, I can no more disown my white grandmother who raised me as a woman sacrificing again and again for me, a woman who loved me as much as she loved anything in the world, but a woman who once confessed her fear of a black man who passed her by on the street and on more than one occasion uttered racist or ethnic stereotypes that made me cringe. This is the woman who gave you a bath? What does that mean to us as we talk about? Isn't that yet an opportunity for us to talk about race in America from a sitting president who understands the dynamics from a real place about race in America? It's time for the conversation and to have an honest conversation. Dr. King, when he wrote Strength to Love, said that there is a deep understanding and a need for agape. A love that is concerned with going the extra mile to ensure the well-being of others. King believed in a world, a better world, but in order to obtain his vision, he argued that we must first face our fears and then master these fears with courage, love, and faith. He preached courage that all should show in their nonviolence stance against segregation. And he believed that all people could possess the strength of courage and the strength to love because we were all made in the image of God. This courage and this strength to love, to hope for a better day, this strength to have faith in the Creator, and most of all, this strength to love all of God's children, no matter their skin color, no matter their difference. If you ask me how we're going to deal with race in America and talk about it, we're going to have the strength to love. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. McGee. That was wonderful. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience. Let me begin by asking this. How can we become more engaged in these important conversations about race? What can we do to create the kinds of spaces necessary for fruitful dialogue?
What we can do is have opportunities like you are having today to host lectures and conversations and town hall meetings where people come together to talk about these issues and not be afraid to approach them head on, not be afraid to go into public spaces and talk to the other, to be in communities where you decide, let me buy my neighbor a $2.25 cup of coffee that doesn't look like me so that I have an opportunity to engage in a conversation with them and dispel my fears. Part of what I shared with you is that I think that we mistaken racism for fear. Most people aren't racist. They're afraid of the other. They're afraid of the unknown.
Thank you. Can you name some contemporary authors who are addressing issues of race in an insightful and productive manner?
That's a hard one. I'm challenged by responding to that in an insightful manner because I think that so many are writing from such personal perspectives around the issues of race, where I would say that there are some great things that have been written by, let's say, Cornel West. I would also argue that there are some things that have not been so well written by Cornel West. There's not anything that I would thoughtfully recommend for anyone to buy at this time, other than my book that'll come out in November. Beacon Press.
Another question from the audience. Some people in the Black Lives Matter movement strongly object to the All Lives Matter response, believing that once again, black concerns are being co-opted by the white world. What is your response to this? Do you think that the Black Lives Matter movement has any worth, any validity?
I understand and recently had a conversation with some of the leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement. I have two observations with regards to it. Certainly, the Black Lives Matters movement matters because the loss of black lives matter. The fact that it works in isolation, for me, becomes the challenge. I have a theory regarding the Black Lives Matter movement. I want to be a millennial, but I guess I'm too old for that. So I'm from this Generation X or something. And then there's this civil rights movement. And I think that we've missed something called what I'm calling now and defined as a gap generation that's connected more to a black power movement that has constructed itself as an isolated group of people that is only interested within itself and thinking that in order for us to be effective, we must concentrate solely on ourselves to get this done for ourselves, by ourselves, because we only matter to ourselves, without understanding that the civil rights movement and the fight for equality was not an isolated movement that was founded by African Americans for African Americans. If you look at the history of the NAACP and the Urban League, for instance, it was the resources and the support of a Jewish woman that was the catalyst for the NAACP. Julius Rosenwald was the back support for the Urban League. So to isolate yourselves into a group to say, we have to do this for ourselves, is the starting place of wrong. So it cannot be Black Lives Matter for just black lives. You must look at a larger context of all lives mattering. You also have to look at what does the movement represent? What is it about? What are the goals and the objectives and the outcomes? And as I said to one of the leaders last week, Tell me what are your goals and your objectives and your outcomes beyond rage and anger. I would join your movement if your movement represented going to Ferguson and sitting in on a police station saying we're having a sit-in like we set in on lunch counters in the 60s to integrate lunch counters. I would join your movement if you said we're going to go to the Department of Justice and we're going to sit in on the Department of Justice for 30 days until we change public policy around policing. What are you doing other than rage and outrage? I mean, I certainly understand that when people lose voice and they have no place to express themselves, that they must find a way to express themselves. If you put me on the west side of Baltimore where no one cares about me on the west side of Baltimore where the elected officials in Baltimore are actually African-American and my councilman is African-American and I don't hear from my own African-American councilman, then I must have some kind of outrage, and that outrage is I'm going to make you hear me, and if a news camera won't come to my community because I want to have a press conference on the block and the only way to get me there is to burn down the CVS, then yes, that's what I'll do. But that's not really effective. So your movement must be effective. And I think the way to make the movement effective is to say, what matters? The loss of life or the value of life? And so the Black Lives Matter movement is more about the loss of life as opposed to the value of life. How do we turn it to the value of life? And that's where my concern is.
Thank you. Thank you. That was very well said. Can a conversation reverse the effects of hundreds of years of racial stereotyping?
I don't think a conversation can reverse the effects, but I think a conversation can begin to reverse the effects. I think that we have to begin to talk, to hear each other, and to learn that these conversations not will only affect our consciousness, but will affect our children's consciousness. I have the pleasure now of having a 3-month-old, an 11-month-old who will be 12, will be a year old on next Friday. I've had him for 3 months now. And I notice how he listens to my conversations. I notice how he's learning from the things that I say. What are our children and our grandchildren learning from what we say? Maybe the conversation will not affect you, but maybe it'll affect 2 to 3 generations from now, which is where we need real impact.
Thank you. Another question from the audience. Few people talk about classism or class struggle in America, but isn't this inextricably tied to racism and just as important to discuss? And how does gender fit into this?
Certainly class and gender are major issues when you talk about race inequality. There's a couple of ways to go with that. Class definitely distinguishes how one experiences racism. I can say to you that I have been fortunate through education and through my family of origin to be a part of a different socioeconomic status, which has in some ways minimized what I've experienced around racism. But yet at the same time, it remains true and apparent. But it definitely plays a large factor in what you experience. As it relates to the issues of gender, certainly women remain oppressed, and we know that they still make 25 cents less on a dollar than men. So that's one dynamic that we still need to address and to deal with in this country. As it relates to the LGBTQ rights, we see certainly an emergence of equality that is happening every day. So there are lots of things that we are seeing progress on, but we have a long ways to go, and it is certainly the catalyst of the civil rights movement that has had great impact on the success and the quality of life for women as well as the LGBTQ community.
Another audience member comments, I'm here because we are a white community. How do we get people to care and talk about these issues when we see no one of a different color in our midst?
Bust them in. You have to find ways to integrate your space. You have to find a way to bring the other in, to be a part of who you are and what you're doing and how you're doing it. I would be delighted to invite my church from Dorchester to come to one of your lectures next year on a Sunday morning, to be here as a part of any conversation that you have so that you can experience the other. Something like that.
Would you advocate for us to go there as well?
Absolutely. You're welcome.
Good idea.
I think that that's one of the ways to do it, to figure out ways to integrate spaces that become comfortable first and then uncomfortable second. Can I share one thing? I was with Stephanie Meeks, who is the president of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. We went to North Philadelphia to visit the Joe Lewis Gym because of some preservation work that I've done. And so we went in a car, and she said, "Release the car, we'll get a taxi out." And I said, "Stephanie, we're in North Philadelphia." She said, "Oh, we're fine, we'll get a taxi out." I said, "Okay." So we released the car to get a taxi out. So about 45 minutes later, we're standing on North Broad Street waiting for a taxi. No taxi came. And so Stephanie was there. She had about 5-carat diamond ring on her finger and standing in North Philadelphia. And I said to her, "We're not going to get a taxi out of here. We'll get a jitney." Anybody knows what a jitney is? So it's like a community car service where you find someone along the road that'll take you for $5. And so I said, "We'll find a jitney. Walk with me a couple of blocks to find a jitney." So we walk for a couple of blocks. And as we're crossing the street, there are these kids on the street who look like total thugs. Total thugs. And so having been a pastor in an urban community, I relate to everybody. So I said, "What's up, guys?" And they say, "What's up?" And you could see Stephanie freeze. And they kept walking. I said, "You all okay?" They said, "Yeah, we're fine." Anyway, they came back, shorten the story. They came back and began a conversation with us to share that they were music artists. They'd graduated from high school. They were trying to get their CD released. And on the corner in North Philadelphia, Stephanie Meeks transformed. They were afraid of her, and she was afraid of them. And she's now supporting these three artists in their work. And the element on that corner in North Philadelphia, which I wouldn't advise her to go to without me, to get a jitney, was fear. So how do we create the space for the other to dispel our fears?
Thank you. We've got time for just one more question. It's been said that current American Christianity emphasizes God's love for all, but largely ignores or downplays our need to respond to racism by practicing love for all of God's creation. If so, are the organized churches responsible in large measure for the continued presence of racism and inequality? We thought we'd throw you a hardball for the last question.
So the short answer is yes. I think that the church has a long way to go to represent this radical Jew with dreadlocks from Nazareth that understood when he went into the synagogue at 13 and picked up the Torah to read what he truly represented. He said that he had come for those who were bruised and oppressed and come to set at liberty those who were captive, that his message was a message of love. When he's questioned about all of the laws, the statutes, and the commands as a Jew, of course, you know, Jesus was a Jew, not a Christian. When he's questioned by that, what is the greatest of them all? He says, "To love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, and mind." And he said, "The second is as great as the first, to love thy neighbor as thyself." And on these two, to crucify, sacrifice, hang, martyr, all the laws and all the prophets. And that was the mandate that he left for what we call the church. So when the church truly understands its commission, then I think it will have truly done its work.